Welcome to Coaching Leaders, the podcast that is dedicated to helping managers become better coaches. Today's episode is powered by 1 Minute Feedback. If you face challenges with receiving feedback that is helpful and encouraging, then you will want to try 1 Minute Feedback. 1 Minute Feedback's cloud-based feedback survey helps you get supportive feedback from your colleagues and external partners. The feedback you receive using 1 Minute Feedback is unique in that it helps you understand what you should keep doing and highlight areas you are encouraged to grow.
We spoke about the empathy and the impulse control. I want to come back to that impulse control because in my mind, it only means I shouldn't get angry. How do I control my anger or anger management, if that's even a right way to call it? Because it's, again, it's some negative connotation here, like anger management course. You're going to go for anger management course. What the heck? But when you spoke about the impulse control, I like to stop with that a little bit longer because I thought impulse control, like I've mentioned, is about not getting angry. And that's what I was working on. You have opened it and explored it and showed me the different ways of looking at it. So can we just dive a little bit more on that concept?
Absolutely. So impulse control lives in the decision-making realm of emotional intelligence. So when you think about how do my emotions influence how I make decisions? And not every emotion is going to be effective for the kind of decision-making we need to make. Sometimes anger is a great emotion to have for a particular decision we need to make. Mm-hmm. Sometimes happy is not the best emotion for a particular decision we need to make. And so we have to be able to resist the temptation of leading into a decision-making process with the current emotional state we're in. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I have to do critical thinking and analytics and get into numbers, I cannot be joyful because my energy is wrong. When I'm joyful, my energy is very eyes up and looking out the window. And, you know, I want to go outside and I want to be with people. So to get down to brass tacks and focus in on numbers and analytics and critical thinking, I can't be joyful. I have to be in more of a state of almost slight irritation because that allows me to focus. So do I even know what triggers me into slight irritation? And if I can harness that and create that experience for myself, then I can get down to brass tacks and get some great solutions because this emotional state makes me access a lot of critical pieces and I don't miss important details. But when I'm happy, I'm like, that'll be great. Don't have to worry about that piece whatsoever. And I could be missing really critical information, right? Yeah. It sounds funny, but it's so interesting when we explore our own sense of when I'm in this emotion, when I'm angry, how does that impact my ability to decide what needs to be done? And so harnessing our anger is kind of critical in feedback because sometimes we need to express the gravity of the situation. Mm-hmm. And if I can regulate and harness how I communicate my anger to someone who really stepped over the line, then they'll get it. They will understand the gravity of the situation and it will pull the right motivational internal trigger for them. If I choose anger as the response to anything that sort of tips me in that direction of, you know, I'm frustrated, I'm irritated, I'm annoyed, I'm, why did you do that? You shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
And I choose anger all the time, then people become desensitized to my anger. They start going, there's Teresa flying off the rails again. Yep. And they don't give any or pay any attention to why it was actually important. And so it's kind of critical, this impulse control capacity. First, don't avoid responding out of an initial emotional reaction. So breathing is our good friend. When we find ourselves wanting to blurt something else, take a couple deep breaths and watch what happens to even your emotional temperature.
Wow. You're right. So going back to the same point that if we choose to bring this anger into feedback conversation, then what we are doing essentially is we're allowing the other person to find a way to, again, to deflect the responsibility and put the focus and attention into something that is different to what initially the conversation was about. And my focus will be on your anger. And you said you you're going berserk, and that's just typical you, and why should I even listen, and again, etc. And we just disconnect. So it's hugely important. Now, one thing that I've realized recently is that we live in this understanding that we have to make decisions then and then. And I've realized that's not the case. And I was really actually proud about myself when I choose to explain to my son what will be the consequence, the punishment for his misbehavior later on because I was angry. So here's the story. He has smashed two mobile phones in the last several months. And my older son got the new one, so I gave him this one, and we had those conversations around taking care, etc., etc. And I'm being in the kitchen. He goes off the stairs, and I just hear poof, poof, phone on the floor. I just grabbed it. In the second, I was in almost in the rage mode. I just grabbed it, looked at that phone, looked at him, put it aside, and I was like, "That's it, no more phones for you." And my son looked at me, and he said, "So how long for?" And normally, I would just throw out the number out of the hat, it would be extremely high. And most important, it wouldn't be doable because once I would, you know, get in grasp of my emotions, I would just feel bad for giving a week without, you know, mobile phone for him. And I was like, Xavier, I'm really angry right now. I'm going to the shop because I was on my way to the shop. When I come back, we'll have this conversation, how long this punishment will last. And I realized once I went to the shop, I came back, had a number in my head that was realistic, was fair, and was adequate to what was done. If I wouldn't do that, if I follow my anger, I would just say, weak. And then next day I would give it to me and would be like, well, that says one thing in 7 days, and drastically it's a one day, so why would I even bother listen to him next time, right?
Mm-hmm. Just imagine to hearing that back. I'm really angry, like the acknowledge, I'm really angry right now, and I need a minute to figure out what's next. Even hearing that allows the individual to process, oh boy, mm-hmm. and gives them space as well to consider what they did, how they did it, the impact to it, the potential punishment, how they feel about a potential punishment. Like they get to explore their own stories around it as well. They might even prep like how, if they say a year, what am I going to come back with? If they say you're now on probation, what am I going to come back with to defend myself, right? Mm-hmm. It even gives them space to explore their own personal responsibility. I've done the same with people on my team where I said, I can't right now. What I do need right now is to go away and consider best course of action. I'd like you to do the same. Mm-hmm. Best course of action. Because what I really want in that space is for neither of us to come with defensive, of defending our position. And it is way too easy when someone says, but this is what I did and this is how it happened. And, you know, you did this part and it wasn't helpful for me. It's way too easy for us to respond to their stuff instead of keeping our eye on where we're supposed to be going.
Yeah.
My response needs to be where we're going, not what we did.
Exactly. So imagine if I actually add a little bit more context in the situation, that would be in a conversation with an employee. And I said, hey, I need a minute and come back. Because what I do want is to make the best possible decision. But what I don't want is to allow my negative emotions right now influence that decision making. That wouldn't be fair and right. So I need to walk away, cool down a little bit, and I'll come back to it with you. Okay. And again, take it on yourself. And then you've made me angry and I now need to go outside and think about it, right? And I'll come back to you and we'll, that sort of conversation. Again, how we communicate that is really important, right? Because if I would just say, hey, you've made me angry, so I need to cool down, again, it's putting a responsibility on someone else.
What a fine demonstration of the behavior you want modeled by your employees as well. So if I am mm-hmm. doing it and communicating why I'm doing it, you're modeling that fair and moral behavior you want your employees to be doing in the first place. It's oftentimes the stuff we're holding them accountable to is often the stuff we're not even doing ourselves. And so that's why, you know, when we talk to them, it just goes over their head because they're like, you're not doing that. Why do I have to do it?
Because I'm your boss. I'm telling you so, right? that's wrong, by the way, but that's how we communicate. And sometimes, as I mentioned, it's not even that we want to communicate that way, but in that moment of that anger and sort of strong emotions, we are defaulting into our job title that we've been given because we've been told it wields such a huge power. But at the same time, every single human being knows that the trust is earned and you have to earn it in the first place. And it's not given that easily. and here we go at workplace. In the workplaces, we are communicating from position of that formal authority, and it is because I said so, because I'm your manager, etc., etc., or I want and I don't want this to happen, etc. That doesn't create that safe space around us.
No, it doesn't. I used that statement once. Only once did I ever use the statement, all right, I'm asking you because I'm your manager, and I need you to do it because I'm your manager asking you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the moment I was saying it, this was an employee who I was a peer with for 5 years, and then I was their leader for 4 years at this point. So we had a long-standing relationship and a great, like, deep relationship, one where we can talk about anything at any time under any circumstances. And then we came to a point where, you know, sometimes towing that line of friendship and professional can get a little muddy sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you can feel, even as a leader, sometimes like, are they taking advantage of that friendship side right now and sort of dropping the ball, knowing that I'll give them another chance? So I found myself in that place wrestling with the decision of using power and authority. And as it came out of my mouth, I could feel myself regulating my emotion with every single word I was saying, because it was so easy to just let it fly out. And I mm-hmm. needed it to be at a certain pace with a certain kind of eye contact and a certain tone in my voice to carry the gravity of that situation. And it turns out, when I did that, very shortly after, my manager asked for feedback from my employees. She did one-to-one conversations, feedback for me that she was going to bundle up and then share with me. And this piece came out for them, like, in the way of, you won't believe what she did. Like, she used these things and said this to me. And then my manager gave me the feedback. And, you know, at first I was a little caught off guard because I was like, oh, shit. Is this going to be something where now I have to learn from it? And so I asked my manager, when she described it to you, what did you interpret as sort of her tone or her takeaway from it? And she said, it seemed like it was something that she really learned from, that there are areas of your relationship that she will push the boundary of when she shouldn't be pushing the boundary of because of your relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So even though it bothered her that you said it, she understood why you said it. And I was like, okay, for me, that's the perfect blend. That's what I was going for. I also didn't want to have to say it because I didn't want for her to be in a position where that was the motivating driver. Because I know that under that means that she's not fulfilled.
Mm-hmm.
So she's needing power to drive forward, because we tried everything under the sun before we got there. And it wasn't getting her there. And it was a last sort of resort. And the heartbreaking part was, it because it stems for the individual, their emotional intelligence, they're having an experience that is negative and uncomfortable, and they're not able to get out of it on their own, no matter how much you've encouraged and done. That seemingly is the, you know, I'm doing it from a point of caring about them and really trying to coach them and whatnot, and they're still stuck. Well, I'm going to have to use that one that maybe snaps them out of it.
Yeah.
And turns out it did work.
Fortunately, that's great.
Yeah, fortunately.
Most of them are not. The employee would think, well, do you believe she said it that way? Again, it's all about her and him, not myself. Rather than claiming the responsibility, then I'm thinking, is there a reason why she phrased it that way? And for that particular reason, I really love the questions, what makes him or her say it. So this is one of most powerful questions that I'm asking myself and others, is what makes you or makes me say it, right? So if you use it, so what makes him actually say it? Because that really opens up me, allows me to slow down and start thinking, is there a reason behind it, rather than just interpret it with my own way, which again, as a human being, our negativity bias would just take us into the road of, you know, it's actually on him, it's his responsibility, not mine, and it's something that he has against me, sort of thing. So what makes me say it, or what makes him or her say it in that case, it's a very powerful moment, because you can then realize, actually, it's on me. I drove Teresa to that point where she had to verbalize it in a certain way towards me.
And then at the same time, I chose that path. As the leader, I chose that path. So there's that independence skill set of emotional intelligence, which is part of our self-expression realm. And self-expression, like how I show up and how I communicate and speak, feeds into the wholeness and quality of the relationships that I form with people. So independence is our ability to be self-directed as a leader, to autonomously make decisions, which does not mean make them without considering other people or other people's data and input. It just means when it comes time to make the decision, the buck stops here with me. I've made it. Then I communicated it outward to people, and I hold people accountable to it. When people challenge me on it, I can describe the process through which I went coming to this decision, which will include things like, I spoke with these departments, these people, I incorporated what you're experiencing, what you might be feeling, I asked certain people about it, I bundled all that up as information, and then I made a decision.
Mm. So in other words, because when you first started saying, explaining it to me, I was like, isn't that what managers do? They're making decisions themselves because, quote unquote, that's their job. But when you've mentioned understanding your thinking process and decision-making process and then being able to articulate it back, if somebody's going to challenge you, ask you the questions, that's a very powerful tool to have. In fact, I'll share something with you right now. This is one of my coaching tools that I always have been using deliberately. So I wouldn't wait for anyone to ask me. When I coach and when I explain my decisions, I explain how I felt, what influenced it, and what consequences I foresee on the back of it. Because I believe transparency is important, but also what I want to do personally is to give you opportunity to contextualize it yourself, understanding the process rather than just make this decision. Because what I personally want as a coaching leader is for you to coach others the same process rather than saying, do it because my manager told me to do so. That's one of the traps that we are all the time. I don't know, I've been told to do it that way and do it that way as well because apparently it works. It saved me half an hour time. But then if people don't understand the process behind it, they would come back to you with another problem and then another problem. If you explain the principles behind it, they can contextualize it and then apply it elsewhere at the same time. And so that's how I operate as a coaching leader. And I believe that's one of the most important skill sets and tools that coaching leaders can put in place is contextualize the coaching decision-making and actually verbalize it, help people understand what was on the back of those decisions rather than the decision has been made. I just follow it.
Yes. I could not agree more. I mean, that's a very short answer to a beautiful way of saying, include all of the information in your communication, not just the end of it. But mm-hmm. oftentimes when we communicate decisions, we only communicate, this is the decision. And that opens up a whole world of questions from everyone else around you. Like, hey, what about? What about? And then you spend so much time answering all of those questions, which basically was your process in the first place. But because you didn't explain it, when you answer questions, people can sometimes interpret your answer as, I'm just thinking about it right now and I'm answering your question, as opposed to that was part of the process that led me here. So what you, in essence, you're doing is you're removing people's barriers to believe that you did the fullness of the work that needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And so I can get on board. And really, that's what we want in decision making, is we want people to get on board. But so we have to do the things in the background that get people on board in the first place, which means we have to ask other people their experiences. Hey, if you were to make this call, what would you do? Why would you do that? And I'm not asking because low independence would mean that I would take your answer and regardless of how I felt or what I thought or what I experienced, I would suppress mine and take yours, because now if it goes wrong, I could just say, oh, that was Stephanie's idea.
Yeah. Again,
that's not a good leader.
And it circles back all the way to taking responsibility, right? Again, deflecting it. I'll take yours as an answer, and just in case, it's yours, not mine, and nobody's going to catch me making those wrong decisions, and it's not on me, right?
Yeah. Which kind of, you know, rolls into something I believe is really important for leaders, is to sort of really understand what is their management philosophy. Mine, I operated very simply out of give away all recognition, assume all responsibility. So when things are going great, you recognize the team and their effort and how it got done because of them. When shit hits the fan, assume all responsibility for what hit the fan, because mm-hmm. you're the leader. So you must assume all responsibility. You buffer your team. So on the surface, you're telling, I'm responsible, because in essence, I am responsible for them, their performance. So if they did something wrong, I'm not going to say, oh, that went wrong because they did something. It's because I didn't lead them well enough, or I didn't catch a mistake, or I didn't catch something about them to be able to make sure it was going to be successful. That's my personal responsibility as the leader.
Yes. It sounds simple, but so difficult to put in place. And as you mentioned, it's all journey, and we're all learning emotional intelligence. And you as a coach, you've mentioned you're still learning your throughout your journey. So what was your recent discovery about yourself on that emotional intelligence journey that you are also embarking on?
Most recently is around the concept of unlearning. Mm-hmm. And so the concept for me around unlearning used to be, and meaning as early as this morning. I had, when I go for my runs, I like to process things around like my evolution and my growth. So this morning I was thinking about, when I go about unlearning or challenging something, what do I usually tend to do? I usually tend to learn a new or better way to fill that space. And I consider that my growth. Mm-hmm. What if when I unlearn something, I just leave the space? I don't fill it with something. What would happen then? For me, I consider leaving the space provides the opportunity for many things to be true. So my growth around EQ is trying to get myself out of as many absolutes. So this is how we go about that. This is how you get success here. This is what these things look like painting these pictures of what mm-hmm. is best, what is right, what is good, what is correct. I mean, as a human being, I live in a ton of absolutes. This is the right way to load the dishwasher. This is the best way to organize my calendar, right? This is what a perfect facilitation of a webinar looks like. Lots of absolutes.
Right.
So what if when I'm challenging myself in that area, instead of filling it with another right answer, quote unquote, right, mm-hmm. I just create the space for options.
You see, my first instinct was to say, I'm not like you, Teresa. I don't have my absolutes. I'm very open and I'm very, very willing to accept there are better ways. But if I contemplate on that, there are some areas when I'm really anchored, and that's the best way of doing so. And here's the example. What I've realized that being transparent and turning every conversation into coaching conversation and giving the opportunity to others is the best way to get people moving forward and develop them. But I've realized it isn't. I was so deeply into it that at some point it worked against me. And even my son, yesterday we actually had a fun conversation. I walked into his room and I said, hey, Nathan, just realized for about 2 weeks, we didn't have any coaching conversations between me and you yet. Something, I feel like I'm neglecting you as my son. And I was like, would you like to book a session with me or something? I was like, no, that I'm okay without you turning even a joke or me listening to music into another coaching conversation. It's a funny way of presenting things and having that conversation, but he's right. I would have this tendency to go over the top with everyone. Why? Because that's how I like it. There's no such thing for me as too much feedback, Teresa. And it might sound cliche to most of you guys. Genuinely, if you know me, if you work with me, there's no such thing like for me as too much feedback. I am growth obsessed, right? I need to feel like I'm growing and developing. I'm not chasing perfection. For me, it doesn't really exist. And that's not important for me. I need to be in a space of growth. Not stagnant. I need to have a Goliath in front of me. And so I need that all the time. And I'm just thinking, that's the best way for everyone else to grow. Bombard them with the feedback. It's just not the case, right? So my initial instinct was to say, oh, I'm not like you, Teresa, at all. I don't care how I put the dishes into the dishwasher, etc. But then if you really think about it, we all have a certain areas when you think, that's the way of being done. Things need to be done. And then we communicate that way, trying to convince everyone, my way or a highway, dude. And actually, my way is the best way, right?
Yes. That level of control could be another way of looking at it, as, you know, how many areas of life do I feel I need to have control over the how, the why, the where, the when, the who, the what, how much of that? And we could spend a week or 2 weeks just watching ourselves like a hawk and cataloging all of the things that, boy, when it wasn't done the way I wanted, did I ever have a reaction? And when I reacted, I behaved in ways that were detrimental to the relationship of the person I was having it with. And even that sort of cataloging exercise can be so mind and eye-opening to our personal EQ journey.
Teresa, whilst you are on the call with me and for our listeners as well, I would like to ask you a question. So I need some help to help somebody else with this default response to everything with a negative slant angle. Right, so the tendency that the person has is straight away look at the dark side, and there is a really good intention behind it, and I know that for sure, that there is filtering through the possible negative scenarios to protect everyone around, and I totally get it. But essentially, it creates a paradigm of behavior when everything is filtered in the first instance through a negative, that those negative stories, and I believe they have that power over our emotional well-being. That's why we are stressed, because we are looking at everything from a negative angle. So the way I look at it always, you've got two types of drivers that are approaching traffic lights. One sees the red one and gets pissed off because, again, him on the red one, why the world is against him or her. And one just approaches the red one and accepts it. That's me. It's the red. Well, it's just a random thing. Why would I even allow something like a light influence my emotional well-being? And so I got into this poor position over the years somehow. I can't fully articulate that, actually. So I can't fully help someone else. But if I want, and I want to help, and if you're the manager who wants to help your employees with starting looking at things from that negative perspective, looking for those excuses and this, yes, but it won't work because, et cetera, et cetera. Where would we start that journey? Where is the sort of the first set of questions that we have to ask ourselves or that person, help them understand that it's not the healthy ways of looking at it, and here's how we can balance it. So that pendulum that you've mentioned, it swings both ways rather than just stays on that negative side.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, that the pendulum doesn't swing so far into the extremes. Let's try and keep it a little less rocky even. It's okay to float a little bit away from zero or neutral, but when we float to the extremes, generally behaviorally, that's when we run into trouble. There's quite a number of books written on this exact topic, like don't sweat the small stuff, happiness is a choice. And oftentimes that can be rooted in personality driver. So in personality assessments, it is the optimism scale as a personality assessor. So low in optimism would be those people who are called pessimists. They look negative side. This is everything that can go wrong. High in optimism are our rose-colored glasses people. Everything they experience is like hope, and it's going to be good. Don't worry about it. And so those are extremes, and neither of them are good on their own. So optimism as a skill set for optimistic people is about turning that dial down, because the balancer to that optimism is reality testing. So being objective, seeing what's really happening and looking at the reality, not the pessimism, the reality. So asking themselves questions like, okay, so everything's going to be great. What could be something that could go wrong? And if that went wrong, what could be the potential sort of negative impact? That doesn't mean I'm pessimistically thinking. It means I'm realistically thinking some of these things could happen. Mm-hmm. It's the exact same from a pessimistic side. Is going, okay, so it's doomsday. Now, what sort of things could go well? What could be a positive outcome? It doesn't mean all of a sudden I'm an optimist. I'm reality looking at it, because we don't know what the future holds. So we have to look around all of it and ask the questions of what could go right, what could go wrong. Oftentimes in leadership, we call this preparing for the future, strategic planning around a project. We do these things naturally. Some people do them naturally as a 360 view. Some people only do it naturally as a 180. They're only looking at one side. So when we apply the skill of optimism, it's about finishing the circle with reality testing and optimism at the same time. So just make sure you pull in the other side of it by asking a few of those questions. related to what could go wrong, what could go right, what would that look like, how would we plan and prepare or respond to it.
Okay, thank you. It's a powerful thing, but I believe we all are guilty of it, I suppose. The question is how often, how frequently, and my concern is if you're constantly looking at those negative signs, it's, yes, it has influence on the relationships and people around you, but my real worry is it has influence over how you feel across the day, because each time that you perceive something that is negative, that cortisol shoots up a little bit by bit, right? So our brain is both sophisticated and it's also primitive. We can tell ourselves into stress just by verbalizing or by creating a wrong stress, right? So it's, for me, it's, wow, it's mind-blowing. But once you realize that actually you can create your own stress, and we can say, you know, the world is stressful, my boss is wrong, my company is wrong. But my question is, what's in your mind across the day? If you're continuously feeding yourself with those negative stuffs and going towards that one angle, which is negative one, you will be stressed across the day. And now you can't access your IQ the way you want it, because stress prohibits that. And so this is, I believe, one of the most important things that we can do. And sadly, nobody who's teaching me that or coaching me at work. And that's another thing that I would like to explore a little bit with you. Because from my experience as a manager and as a feedback coach, is that we are so focused on those technical skills, which we all discuss is not the most important thing. Even Google launched this incredible project, Oxygen. And so they wanted to find out if actually managers are needed in the first place. It turned out it's not, managers are not only needed, they come up with 8 and now update into 10 behaviors that the best manager has, and technical skills are number 8. It's not the most important thing to know things. Being a good coach is the most important part within the Google thing. But that's not what I want to say. What I'm actually heading towards is we are so fixed and focused on teaching those technical skills of the job that we're forgetting about teaching the empathy, teaching self-control, self-awareness, etc. Almost nobody but one leader did that with me. And boy, my life would be such a great place if somebody did that from the early ages. So I'm avoiding conversations on sort of organizational level, but I think we have to ask that question. Why organizations are not prioritizing emotional intelligence the way it should have? What's your opinion and your experience?
Well, my opinion and experience are slowly becoming close to the same. Because the more I experience other companies, the more my opinion on why it might be happening is being demonstrated. So that's why I'm closing the gap on, mm-hmm. Oh, so what I thought it was is actually happening. The biggest problem in this area is what we measure. So if I'm measuring your performance based on certain KPI indicators, then that's what I'm going to be looking for. And those are the things I'm going to want to teach. And that's what we spend time in learning and development on. So EQ is not at the top because we're not measuring it as a key performance indicator for success. Even though all the research says you should be measuring these as performance measures for success. And oftentimes that barrier is because, well, what does it look like? How do I observe empathy in the workplace? How do I observe impulse control in the workplace? How do I observe? And because companies aren't doing this right now, and their internal HR companies probably lack the knowledge around EQ to be able to answer those questions, they're not changing their performance management processes or criteria. They're also not hiring people for this, succession planning for it, promoting for it. The internal processes aren't shifting fast enough so that we acquire people looking for these criteria, and then we measure them on those criteria as well. It's a simple, it's actually a very simple solution, is that you need to get an EQ specialist into your organization to help teach your HR department and then all of your hiring managers. How do we look for it? How do we measure it? And then change your processes to reflect it and teach people how to do it that way. It doesn't mean we throw out all of our current KPI metrics. It means we have to add the EQ ones in as well so we can look for them.
Yeah, and my opinion actually is, even if you are against it or you don't think it's right to do, but you're lazy or you think you don't have time for it, look at it from this perspective. List things that you have to do within your job role or what it takes to be promoted, and you're going to come up with 20, 30, 40 things. And I know when I got first my job description that I was working towards as a next step, it just was so overwhelming. In reality, what I had to do is develop 4 or 5 skills, and I could nail all of those with those 4 or 5 skills. So improve your communication skills a little bit and then focus on 2 or 3 things, listening skills, a bit more empathy, and you can literally nail most of the things that are required for you to deliver those results. So you have to focus actually on less skill sets if you focus on EQ almost than if you would work on those technical abilities, etc., etc., and continuously feed around those aspects and those criteria.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you mentioned that is kind of perfect here is, you know, EQ is often the foundation of a skill that allows us to execute on that technical skill. And stress tolerance is a really big one. So, you know, our ability to cope with things that are changing, when situations are shifting, when uncertainty is present, do we have the skill set to cope with that? And any workplace, those kind of emotions are constant, like uncertainty and change and something new and I don't know how I handle this. Or when we take a look at something like impulse control, delaying our reaction to something, stress tolerance is a supporting player to us having impulse control. So if I can cope with difficulty, that also means I'm aware of this emotion arising that's creating stress for me. So this individual coach who does or doesn't want to do things, am I aware of what it feels like in me when I do or don't want to do things, because now that's speaking to my worth and my capacity, and now people aren't going to trust me or think I'm a good leader or whatever. I've got this emotion playing in here, and that's creating an element of stress. And because I'm stressed out, now I'm headed into rash decision-making. And this rash decision-making comes out in X, Y, and Z KPI measurables. Like, we decided this on this project way too early in the process, and then we weren't flexible. We didn't change our mind. We just kept going forward. The project failed. Well, we can rewind that all the way back to that person's self-regard. And can we measure someone's self-regard? Not necessarily, but we can measure the impulse control, their decision-making process, like how they went through that. We've got those metrics already lined up. To your point on a job profile, you could probably highlight it right now, all the words that are EQ related. And you're going to notice like 68% of them will be EQ related. Very little of them are technical skill related. Communication's not a technical skill set.
Yep, true that. It's like when you watch managers and how they coach and how they then train employees that are underperforming, is you would notice this pattern that I told you how to do it technically. Job. So it could be how to fill a format, or how to fill the report, or it could be how to cook the burgers on the grill, right? So I told you the technical skills. Then there is a pressure, you're underperforming, and the manager goes back and retrains those technicalities. And then there is a frustration because I know how to cook the burger. I know how to fill that format. It's that simple. I'm not dumb. There's something else that prevents me. What else? High cortisol. Where does it come from? Stress. I haven't managed the stress well enough. I don't know how to slow down. The stories that I'm telling myself are negative. It all adds up. It all builds up to how we feel, how we are overwhelmed and stressed. And then my IQ is being diminished. I can't no longer access those information, and I can't perform that. I can't execute it. If you explain to the door host in the restaurant how to sit your restaurant, and then all of a sudden she's making silly mistakes, it's not because she forgot what's the pattern and the best way to seat the restaurant. It's because there are a few guests that want things now, and they are just giving their mouth and being rude. That's the real challenge in here, rather than you don't know, or have you forgot that you can't seat 3 tables in one section? No, she hasn't forgot. She's just flooded in cortisol, and she has no access to that whatsoever anymore. She's now focused on those rude people. Now she's scared of having another people that will be even more rude. Now her day is ruined. Totally different skill sets, yet so relevant and important and influence that influences everything else around.
Which is why when organizations choose to throw more training at people, it rarely sticks.
Yeah.
They're lacking that underlying EQ skill set to be able to execute when they're emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out we get emotional a lot.
All the time. It's just not that something that we are willing to talk about and admit in the workplace often. And again, we are living in the world when working with people from all over the world, from different nationalities. And we all were raised in slightly different ways. It has huge influence over how we behave and who we are. And I'll be totally honest with you. I will never forget one of the most important experiences in my life is when we had our first son, Nathan, and he's 16 now, Justina. She asked me very important questions. She was like, what will you do if our son turns out to be homosexual? Now, Teresa, I remember the anger that I felt. I was almost raging with a very valid question. Now, I don't hold myself accountable against that feelings and emotions. I don't think I was a bad person back then. I was a person influenced with the circumstances and reality that I was raised in, and I didn't know otherwise. Basically, I was told certain things are good, certain things are bad, certain things shouldn't have happened. Unfortunately, I was raised in an environment and told that being homosexual is something bad. And so I was conflicted between love and this question that just irritated me and angered me. And I was like, we'll get there, we'll look at it if it happens, kind of like denying it, sort of like that was the easiest way to skip through this conversation. Today, I'm a totally different person. It's fine. For me, it's very simple. You have to do two things. You have to be a good person and doing good things to others. As long as you don't harm others emotionally and physically, I love you, man. I love everyone on this planet as long as you do those two things. But it only shows that the environment has influence over me, who I am as a person. And we bring it all to work, certain beliefs. And it ranges from how I perceive being professional. Again, as a Polish person, we are raised to be professional. And in the UK, we are seen as high, really hardworking people and very professional. But that has its own bias as well and negative impacts. Like you mentioned right at the beginning, how my behavior, you know, how does it influence others in a negative way? Being highly professional has a negative impact in the workplace because that closes the doors for empathy. That's not professional behavior. I don't need to understand what you do. You need to be professional. You need to leave your emotions behind the door, period. So we have to be mindful that we are working in cultures where people are from all over the world. And if you are an empathetic person, you've been raised that way, or you're from the culture that is so open, the another person is not just a bad person, it's just they were raised differently and you have to accept that, and all the way around as well.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most powerful tools for a coaching leader is to know the owner's manual of every individual that they're taking care of. So what does it look like for you when you're stressed? Like, how do you respond to high stress, medium stress, low stress situations? What are the things that trigger stress for you? How will I know what that looks like? And what's the best way to go about working with you in those situations? Because turns out I know my owner's manual. Mm-hmm. So I am personally responsible to figuring out what's in it and to keep it up to date, because as I grow, my owner's manual changes. Sometimes I will erase things and not fill something else in its place. And sometimes I will add things to it. But as a leader, we need to know what's in the manual, because it turns out we have to know how to best work with those quirks and idiosyncrasies of each individual based on their entire emotional and relational history that comes with them. And if we're not willing to find that stuff out, then we're probably going to accept that we're going to have high turnover and low employee engagement. If we're okay with that, then go ahead. But you know, if you're trying to change those things, which most companies are, then you might want to change how you go about doing it.
I guess that a lot of managers would say, no, I'm not okay with low turnover, with low staff morale, but I'm not the part of the problem. It's them not being professional. No, but you're absolutely right. We have to understand where we're coming from. So for me, I look at it from the way that everyone's just like a blank CV once I hire them. And I'm starting feeling the gaps myself rather than accepting what was in your actual CV. I just watch and observe and ask you those questions, and I will try to figure it out. What is that your manual that you spoke about just now? And make sure I'm filling it up and I'm aware of those certain things, because then that will help me to ask the right questions or behave with you in the right way or approach you from the right angle to get the best out of you and have those difficult conversations together, because I understand what I can and cannot do with you, what's the best way and what's not the best way to approach you as an individual. Super powerful. Wow, this has been a pleasure to chat with you, Teresa. Really, I've learned a lot myself, and I hope our listeners as well. Now, I know you have your own podcast as well, and I know you're super active on LinkedIn. In fact, you are the person who delivers the highest value, the most frequently and consistently that I've ever seen, honestly. And I have 15,000 people in my network, and I've seen a lot of content creators, and I always watch your videos with pleasure because there's always something to learn. So I know LinkedIn is one way we can reach out to you and learn something from you and about you. I know you have your own podcast, and I'll leave those links in the description. What else we can get in touch with you and learn more about you?
That is, LinkedIn's the best spot because it will direct you to my website, which has more information around like how I go to work with people. So how I build emotionally intelligent organizations, what that looks like, any events that I may have coming up, if I'm doing a free webinar, if I have a course coming up or something like that, that people can register for, become a part of. And the website is www.iqeqtq.com. All the Qs, Brad.
Talent quoting. I love it. Nice. Wow. Thank you very much, Teresa, for today. And gosh, emotional intelligence, such an important topic. We got to get it right, right? We got to focus. We have to have those conversations, and we have to bring it into the workplace. So if you got any more questions around emotional intelligence, please reach out to Teresa, or just simply go to the LinkedIn, connect, and watch those videos. I promise you, you will learn tons just from doing that.